A day or two after that visit to Stoke in the infirmary, I called my mother and said that if she could really afford to send a little extra cash my way, I'd like to take her up on her idea about getting a tutor. She didn't ask many questions and didn't scold. You knew you were in serious trouble with my mom when she didn't scold. But 3 days later, I had a money order for $300. To this, I added my heart's winnings. I was astonished to find they came to almost $80. That's a lot of nickels. I never told my mom, but I actually hired two tutors with her $300. One a grad student who helped me with the mysteries of tectonic plates and continental drift. The other a pot-smoking senior from King Hall who helped Skip with his anthropology and might have written a paper or two for him, although I don't know that for sure. This second fellow's name was Harvey Brundage, and he was the first person to ever say, "Wow, man, bummer," in my presence. Together, Skip and I went to the Dean of Arts and Sciences. There was no way we were going to go to Gerritsen, not after that November meeting in the Chamberlain Rec, and laid out the problems we were facing. Technically, neither of us belonged to A&S. As freshmen, we weren't yet eligible to declare majors, but Dean Randall listened to us. He recommended that we go around to each of our instructors and explain the problem, more or less throw ourselves on their mercy. We did it, loathing every minute of the process. One of the factors that made us powerful friends in those years was being raised with the same Yankee ideas, one of which was that you didn't ask for help unless you absolutely had to, and maybe not even then. The only thing that got us through that embarrassing round of calls was the buddy system. When Skip was in with his teachers, I waited for him out in the hall, smoking one cigarette after another. When it was my turn, he waited for me. As a group, the instructors were a lot more sympathetic than I ever would have guessed. Most bent over backwards to help us not only pass, but pass high enough to hold on to our scholarships. Only Skip's calculus teacher was completely unreceptive, and Skip was doing well enough there to skate by without any special help. Years later, I realized that for many of the instructors it was a moral issue rather than an academic one. They didn't want to read their ex-students' names in a casualty list and have to wonder if they had been partially responsible, that the difference between a D and a C- had also been the difference between a kid who could see and hear and one sitting senseless in a VA hospital somewhere. After one of these meetings, and with the end of semester exams looming, Skip went to the Bear's Den to meet his anthro tutor for a coffee-fueled cram session. I had dish line at Holyoke. When the conveyor finally shut down for the afternoon, I went back to the dorm to resume my own studies. I stopped in the lobby to check my mailbox, and there was a pink package slip in it. The package was brown paper and string, but livened up with some stick-on Christmas bells and holly. The return address hit me in the stomach like an unexpected sucker punch. Carol Gerber, 172 Broad Street, Harwich, Connecticut. I hadn't tried to call her, and not just because I was busy trying to save my ass. I don't think I realized the real reason until I saw her name on that package. I'd been convinced she'd gone back to Sully John, that the night we'd made love in my car while the oldies played was ancient history to her now, that I was ancient history. Phil Oakes was playing on Nate's record player, but Nate himself was snoozing on his bed with a copy of Newsweek lying open on his face. General William Westmoreland was on the cover. I sat down at my desk, put the package in front of me, reached for the string, then paused. My fingers were trembling. "Hearts are tough," she had said. "Most times they don't break. Most times they only bend." She was right, of course, but mine hurt. As I sat there looking at the Christmas package she had sent me, it hurt plenty. Phil Oakes was on the record player, but in my mind I was hearing older, sweeter music. In my mind I was hearing the Platters. I snapped the string, tore the tape, removed the brown paper, and eventually liberated a small white department store box. Inside was a gift wrapped in shiny red paper and white satin ribbon. There was also a square envelope with my name written on it, in her familiar hand. I opened the envelope and pulled out a Hallmark card, when you care enough to send the very best, and all that. There were foil snowflakes and foil angels blowing foil trumpets. When I opened the card, a newspaper clipping fell out onto the present she'd sent me. It was from a newspaper called the Harwich Journal. In the top margin, above the headline, Carol had written, "This time I made it, Purple Heart. Don't worry, 5 stitches at the emerge room and I was home for supper." The story's headline read, "6 injured, 14 arrested as draft office protest turns into melee." The photo was in stark contrast to the one in the Derry News, where everyone, even the cops and the construction workers who had started their own impromptu counter-protest, looked sort of relaxed. In the Harwich Journal photo, folks looked raw-nerved, confused, and about 2,000 light-years from relaxed. There were hard-hat types with tattoos on their bulging arms and hateful grimaces on their faces. There were long-haired kids staring back at them with angry defiance. One of the latter was holding his arms out to a jeering trio of men as if to say, "Come on, you want a piece of me?" There were cops between the two groups, looking strained and tense. To the left, Carol had drawn an arrow to this part of the photo, as if I might have missed it otherwise, was a familiar jacket with Harwich High School printed on the back. Once more her head was turned, but this time toward the camera instead of away from it. I could see the blood running down her cheek much more clearly than I wanted to. She could draw joke arrows and write all the breezy comments she wanted to in the margin. I was not amused. That was not chocolate syrup on her face. A cop had her by one arm. The girl in the news photo didn't seem to mind either that or the fact that her head was bleeding, if she even knew her head was bleeding at that point. The girl in the news photo was smiling. In one of her hands was a sign reading, "Stop the murder." The other was held out toward the camera, the first 2 fingers making a V. V for victory, I thought then, but of course it wasn't. By 1969, that V went with the sparrow track the way ham went with eggs. I scanned the text of the clipping, but there was nothing there of any particular interest. Protest? Counter-protest, epithets, thrown rocks, a few fistfights, police arrive on the scene. The story's tone was lofty and disgusted and patronizing all at the same time. It reminded me of how Ebersole and Gerritsen had looked that night in the wreck. "You fellows have disappointed me." All but 3 of the protesters who had been arrested were released later that day, and none were named, so presumably they were all under 21. Blood on her face, and yet she was smiling, triumphant, in fact. I became aware Phil Oakes was still singing, "I must have killed 1,000,000 men, and now they want me back again," and a shake of goose flesh went up my back. I turned to the card. It bore the typical rhymed sentiments. They always come to about the same, don't they? "Merry Christmas. Sure hope you don't die in the new year." I barely read them. On the blank side, facing the verse, she had written me a note. It was long enough to use up most of the white space. "Dear number 6, I just wanted to wish you the merriest of Merry Christmases and to tell you I'm okay. I'm not back in school, although I have been associating with certain school types, see enclosed clipping, and expect I will return eventually, probably fall semester next year. My mom is not doing too well, but she is trying, and my brother is getting his act back together. Rhonda helps, too. I've seen Sully a couple of times, but it's not the same. He came over to watch TV one night, and we are like strangers. Or maybe what I really mean is that we're like old acquaintances on trains going in different directions. I miss you, Pete. I think our trains are going in different directions, too, but I'll never forget the time we spent together. It was the sweetest and the best, especially the last night. You can write me if you want, but I sort of wish you wouldn't. It might not be good for either of us. This doesn't mean I don't care or remember, but that I do. Remember the night I showed you that picture and told you about how I got beaten up? How my friend Bobby took care of me? He had a book that summer. The man upstairs gave it to him. Bobby said it was the best book he ever read. Not saying much when you're just 11, I know. But I saw it again in the high school library when I was a senior and read it, just to see what it was like. and I thought it was pretty great. Not the best book I ever read, but pretty great. I thought you might like a copy. Although it was written 12 years ago, I sort of think it's about Vietnam. Even if it's not, it's full of information. I love you, Pete. Merry Christmas, Carol. P.S. Get out of that stupid card game. I read it twice, then folded the clipping carefully and put it back in the card, my hands still shaking. Somewhere I think I still have that card, as I'm sure that somewhere Red Carol Gerber has still got her little snapshot of her childhood friends. If she's still alive, that is. Not exactly a sure thing. A lot of her last known bunch of friends are not. I opened the package. Inside it, and in jarring contrast to the cheery Christmas paper and white satin ribbon, was a paperback copy of Lord of the Flies by William Golding. I had somehow missed it in high school, opting for A Separate Piece in Senior Lit instead because Piece looked a little shorter. I opened it, thinking there might be an inscription. There was, but not the sort I had expected, not at all. What I found in the white space on the title page was a Valentine heart, the sort a child might draw, followed by a plus sign, a peace sign, and then an equal sign. On the right side of the equation was one word. I spoke the whole thing aloud in a whisper that hardly escaped my mouth. Love plus peace equals information. My eyes filled with sudden, unexpected tears. I put my hands over my mouth to hold in the sob that wanted to come out. I didn't want to wake Nate up, didn't want him to see me crying. But I cried all right. I sat there at my desk and cried for her, for me, for both of us, for all of us. I can't remember hurting any more in my life than I did then. Hearts are tough, she said. Most times hearts don't break, and I'm sure that's right. But what about then? What about who we were then? What about hearts in Atlantis? In any case, Skip and I survived. We did the makeup work, squeaked through the finals, and returned to Chamberlain Hall in mid-January. Skip told me he'd written a letter to John Winken, the baseball coach, over the holiday, saying he'd changed his mind about coming out for the team. Nate was back on Chamberlain 3. So, amazingly, was Lenny Doria, on Academic Pro, but there. His paisan, Tony DeLuca, was gone, though. So were Mark St. Pierre, Barry Margot, Nick Prouty, Brad Witherspoon, Harvey Twiller, Randy Eccles, and Ronnie, of course. We got a card from him in March. It was postmarked Lewiston and simply addressed to the Yo-Yos of Chamberlain 3. We taped it up in the lounge, over the chair where Ronnie had most often sat during the games. On the front was Alfred E. Newman, the Mad Magazine cover boy. On the back, Ronnie had written, Uncle Sam calls and I gotta go. Palm trees in my future and who gives an F blank blank K? What me worry? I finished with 21 match points. That makes me the winner. It was signed, Ron. Skip and I had a laugh at that. As far as we were concerned, Mrs. Malenfant's foul-mouthed little boy was going to be a Ronnie until the day he died. Stoke Jones, a.k.a. Rip Rip, was also gone. I didn't think of him much for a while, but his face and memory came back to me with startling, if brief, vividness, a year and a half later. I was in jail at the time, in Chicago. I don't know how many of us the cops swept up outside the convention center on the night Hubert Humphrey was nominated, but there were a lot, and a lot of us were hurt. A Blue Ribbon Commission would a year later designate the event a police riot in its report. I ended up in a holding cell meant for 15 prisoners, 20 max, with about 60 gassed out, punched out, drugged out, beat up, messed up, worked over, fucked over, blood all over hippies, some smoking joints, some crying, some puking, some singing protest songs. From far over in the corner, issuing from some guy I never even saw, came a stoned-out version of, I'm not marching anymore. It was like some weird penal version of telephone booth cramming. I was jammed up against the bars, trying to protect my shirt pocket, Paul Mall's, and my hip pocket, the copy of Lord of the Flies Carol had given me, now very battered, missing half its front cover and falling out of its binding, when all at once Stokes' face flashed into my mind as bright and complete as a high-resolution photograph. It came from nowhere, it seemed, perhaps the product of a dormant memory circuit which had gone momentarily hot, joggled by either a nightstick to the head or a revivifying whiff of tear gas. And a question came with it. "What the fuck was a cripple doing on the third floor?" I asked out loud. A little guy with a huge mass of golden hair, a kind of Peter Frampton dwarf, if you could dig that, looked around. His face was pale and pimply. Blood was drying beneath his nose and on one cheek. "What, man?" he asked. "What the fuck was a cripple doing on the third floor of a college dorm, one with no elevator? Wouldn't they have put him on the first floor?" Then I remembered Stoke plunging toward Holyoke with his head down and his hair hanging in his eyes, Stoke muttering rip, 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 rip under his breath, Stoke going everywhere as if everything was his enemy. Give him a quarter and he'd try to shoot down the whole world. "Man, I'm not following you. What?" "Unless he asked them to," I said. "Unless he maybe right out demanded it." "Bingo," said the little guy with the Peter Frampton hair. "Got a joint, man? I want to get high. This place sucks. I want to go to Hobbiton." Skip became an artist, and he's famous in his own way. Not like Norman Rockwell, and you'll never see a reproduction of one of Skip's sculptures on a plate offered by the Franklin Mint. But he's had plenty of shows. London, Rome, New York, last year in Paris. And he's reviewed regularly. There are plenty of critics who call him Jejun, the flavor of the month. Some have been calling him the flavor of the month for 25 years. A trite mind communicating via low imagery with other trite minds. Other critics have praised him for his honesty and energy. I tend in this direction, but I suppose I would. I knew him back in the day. We escaped the great sinking continent together, and he has remained my friend. In a distant way, he has remained my paisan. There are also critics who have commented on the rage his work so often expresses, the rage I first saw clearly in the papier-mâché Vietnamese family tableau he set afire in front of the school library to the amplified pulse of the Youngbloods back in 1969. And yeah, there's something to that. Some of Skip's stuff is funny, and some of it's sad, and some of it's bizarre, but most of it looks angry. Most of his stiff-shouldered plaster and paper and clay people seem to whisper, "Light me. Oh, light me and listen to me scream. It's really still 1969. It's still the Mekong, and always will be." "It is Stanley Kirk's anger which makes his work worthy," a critic wrote during an exhibition in Boston. And I suppose it was that same anger which contributed to his heart attack 2 months ago. His wife called and said Skip wanted to see me. The doctors believed it hadn't been a serious cardiac event, but the captain begged to disagree. My old paisan Captain Kirk thought he was dying. I flew down to Palm Beach, and when I saw him, a white face below mostly white hair on a white pillow, it called up a memory I could not at first pin down. "You're thinking of Jones," he said in a husky voice, and of course he was right. I grinned, and at the same moment a cold chill traced a finger down the middle of my back. Sometimes things come back to you, that's all. Sometimes they come back. I came in and sat down beside him. "Not bad, O Swami." "Not hard, either," he said. "It's that day at the infirmary all over again, except that Carberry's probably dead, and this time I'm the one with the tube in the back of my hand." He raised one of his talented hands, showed me the tube, then lowered it again. "I don't think I'm going to die anymore. At least, not yet." "Good. You still smoking?" "I've retired, as of last year." He nodded. "My wife says she'll divorce me if I don't do the same, so I guess I better try." "It's the worst habit. Actually, I think living's the worst habit." "Save the phrase-making shit for the Reader's Digest, Cap." He laughed, then asked if I'd heard from Nady. A Christmas card, like always, with a photo. Fucking Nate. Skip was delighted. Was it his office? Yeah, he's got a nativity scene out front this year. The Magi all look like they need dental work. We looked at each other and began to giggle. Before Skip could really get going, he began to cough. It was eerily like Stoke. For a moment, he even looked like Stoke. And I felt that shiver slide down my back again. If Stoke had been dead, I'd have thought he was haunting us, but he wasn't. And in his own way, Stoke Jones was as much of a sellout as every retired hippie who progressed from selling cocaine to selling junk bonds over the phone. He loves his TV coverage, does Stoke. When O.J. Simpson was on trial, you could catch Stoke somewhere on the dial every night, just another vulture circling the carrion. Carol was the one who didn't sell out, I guess. Carol and her friends, and what about the chem students they killed with their bomb? It was a mistake. I believe that with all my heart. The Carol Gerber I knew would have no patience with the idea that all power comes out of the barrel of a gun. The Carol I knew would have understood that was just another fucked-up way of saying we had to destroy the village in order to save it. But do you think the relatives of those kids cared that it was a mistake? The bomb didn't go off when it was supposed to? Sorry? Do you think questions of who sold out and who didn't matter to the mothers, fathers, brothers, sisters, lovers, friends? Do you think it matters to the people who have to pick up the pieces and somehow go on? Hearts can break. Yes, hearts can break. Sometimes I think it would be better if we died when they did, but we don't. Skip worked on getting his breath back. The monitor beside his bed was beeping in a worried way. A nurse looked in and Skip waved her off. The beeps were settling back to their previous rhythm, so she went. When she was gone, Skip said, "Why did we laugh so hard when he fell down that day?" That question has never entirely left me. "No," I said, "me either." "So what's the answer? Why did we laugh?" "Because we're human." For a while, I think it was between Woodstock and Kent State, we thought we were something else, but we weren't. "We thought we were stardust," Skip said, almost with a straight face. "We thought we were golden," I agreed, laughing, "and we've got to get ourselves back to the garden." "Lean over, hippie boy," Skip said, and I did. I saw that my old friend, who had outfoxed Deary and Ebersole and the Dean of Men, who had gone around and begged his teachers to help him, who had taught me to drink beer by the pitcher and say fuck in a dozen different intonations, was crying a little bit. He reached up his arms to me. They had gotten thin over the years, and now the muscles hung rather than bunched. I bent down and hugged him. "We tried," he said in my ear. "Don't you ever forget that, Pete. We tried." I suppose we did. In her way, Carol tried harder than any of us and paid the highest price, except, that is, for the ones who died. And although we've forgotten the language we spoke in those years, it is as lost as the bell-bottom jeans, home tie-dyed shirts, Nehru jackets, and signs that said, "Killing for peace is like fucking for chastity." Sometimes a word or two comes back. Information, you know. Information. And sometimes, in my dreams and memories, the older I get, the more they seem to be the same. I smell the place where I spoke that language with such easy authority. A whiff of earth, a scent of oranges, and the fading smell of flowers.